Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. This is Jim Inkster, and we're glad you're listening to our Memorial Day broadcast. And our guest is Dr. and Dean Richard D. White. He is the gentleman who's led the fabled LSU School of Business for the last 8 years as dean. He's been part of the faculty for 22 years, and he has a long and distinguished career in academia and also is a prominent author. And we're going to talk about all those things because Dean White is soon to be leaving his post, and he will be in retirement. But as we know, he will not be idle because he is a man of the world, a Renaissance man, if there ever was one. And in addition to everything else, on this day, it's appropriate to note that he retired from the Coast Guard after 24 years with the rank of captain, and I know in many ways you believe that shaped everything else that was to come.
Absolutely. There's not a day that goes by that I don't harken back to my military service, the leadership I learned, all the world travels that it gave me, the vision it gave me, the strategic values, ethics, every day.
And you were born in the great city of Williamsburg, Virginia, and for a historian, as you are, in addition to being an economist and a business academician of note, you couldn't have grown up in a better city.
Absolutely. My mother was a historian there. I saw every president. I've said before, I never knew. I've always been a biographer. I just didn't know it. I mean, growing up there, my high school foreign affairs class had Marshal Tito as a guest. I remember walking out to the main street, and we watched a carriage go by, and sitting in the carriage was the queen, and she's still my queen.
Well, he arrived at LSU in 1998, did Dean White, and he is, in addition to everything else, remains a professor in the Department of Public Administration, and he is a gentleman who will live in Baton Rouge after his official retirement on July 1st. And there must be some, I would say, bittersweet feelings about leaving as business dean. This is your home, and it's been a big part of your identity and what you do.
Yeah, bittersweet really puts the word on it. I've such mixed emotions. Certainly the biggest emotion is leaving the people, my staff and my faculty who I just adore and love, and who've supported me all these years. We've done great things together. I'll have an office in the building that I hopefully will eventually go back to, because I will be in emeritus status. So I'll still be some writing and still be around, but but on the same note, it's time, Jim. I'm 74. I'm not as energetic as I was. And it's time for some youth to come into the job.
Well, during Dean White's tenure, the E.J. Uso College of Business raised more than $45 million. So he has been a prolific fundraiser. And as we know, Dean, this is a big part of academia now. This mantra that we've got to run government like a business, well, quite often we have to run universities like a business.
We really do. It's funny, when I became dean, my only trepidation was fundraising. I thought, how can I, do I have the charisma to do it? And come find out it wasn't about charisma, it was about trust. And I've met some of the most wonderful people around the country, around the world, who are LSU supporters and alumni. And it's just been a pleasure. I mean, the stories you hear, the successes of our LSU graduate, there's something special about LSU graduates. They're not only successful and happy, but they're happy people. And that has been a real, real thrill. And I've really enjoyed bringing in the funds that we so sorely need and we're going to need in the future.
Well, you have been on this program many times, and it's usually in your role as a historian and author, and being the pride of Williamsburg, Virginia, we know why you came about this. But the two biographical targets for Dean Richard White are fascinating people and extremely relevant in this time of Donald Trump. Will Rogers and Huey Long, both of whom might have been president had they not died. Will Rogers was 55 when he died on 15 August 1935 in a plane crash in Alaska with Wiley Post. And Huey Long was 42 when he died 10 September 35, 26 days later in Baton Rouge, assassinated at the state capitol. And these guys were characters, and Rogers was probably more popular than Long nationally, but Long, of course, as we know, had millions of people listening to his radio broadcasts, and he was a force of nature himself. And you chose them as targets for your research and your abilities as a writer. And as I stated, Dean White, I think they are particularly relevant in this time.
Absolutely, both are, and I think of both of them often. How would Huey respond to this situation? How would he take advantage of it politically? I will say that Huey had a big heart for the common people of Louisiana, and he would go all out to solve a crisis like this. One of the things, in fact, it's not in my book, but Huey hired black doctors and dentists to go around the state to give free health care to indigent blacks, one of which was Andrew Young's father, who was a dentist out of New Orleans and traveled around the country, around the state in that program. And Huey's work with the charity hospitals was way ahead of its time. So I think from a tactical standpoint, from a medical standpoint, and a humanistic standpoint, Huey would have risen to the occasion. He had the energy and the intelligence to do it, and he would have been very effective. But at the same time, Huey was not the one to let an opportunity go by to use such a situation like this politically to bolster his power, to bolster his reputation nationally, to attack the national government, whoever would be in. But it would be an interesting time for Huey. He would rise to the occasion in most cases, but at the same time, his political ambition would always haunt him.
In a few months, it will be 85 years since his assassination. And for those who think that this time is like no other, well, any time is like no other, but these are perilous moments. We know that with a pandemic in our midst. But to think about Baton Rouge in 1935, in the midst of the Great Depression, Huey Long declared martial law. How was our city in that moment?
Well, it was split right down the middle. Either you were pro Huey or against him, or violently against him. If you were a Huey supporter, you would not be eligible for any state jobs, any local teaching jobs. You name it. He controlled everyone under his power. It went to the extent that the children of Huey's friends did not date the children of Huey's enemies. This came to pass when he declared martial law, which, by the way, Will Rogers came down and visited during that time and met with Huey and met with his opponents and wrote several columns about it. And he was pretty negative toward Huey by that time. They got along well. They were kind of friends and they joked a lot, but Will really saw through that and was really worried about Huey's threat to democracy.
And the irony was that both of them were months away from the end of their lives. And it was Will Rogers who famously said, "I never met a man I didn't like." Now, Huey Long, 42 years old when he was assassinated, what you're describing about the city and the state and even nationally, people split down the middle with him. Is this analogous to what we're experiencing with President Trump?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very sad. I mean, this is a time for healing and coming together and not for splitting asunder. I would hope we would see, as Lincoln would say, the better angels of our nature, and that would overpower any discontent. But I'm not sanguine about what's going on now. I really am not. It's very distressing. It's very sad. It's sad. but I still have faith in the country. You know, 90% of the people are going to rise to it, are going to treat their neighbors, with kindness and understanding, and we'll get through this. We've gotten through many tragedies in this country, we've overcome a lot of obstacles, and we will in this case as well.
We're visiting with Richard White. He is the dean of the LSU School of Business. He's been there 22 years, 8 as dean, and he is the author of biographies, compelling ones, about both Will Rogers and Huey Long, who died within 3.5 weeks of one another in 1935. And when we return, we'll talk about what the time was like then, as Franklin Roosevelt was ramping up for a reelection campaign, and he knew fully well of the popularity of both Long and Rogers as he was seeking his second term in office. We return with Dean Richard White after this pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and we're glad you're spending time with us on Memorial Day. Hope you're enjoying your holiday, and we're with Dean Richard White, who'll be leaving his post at LSU in one of the most important departments at the Old Wharf School on July 1st. Now, when he announced this a year or so ago, he had no idea that we would have a pandemic in our midst, but that's what we have, and times have changed. And Richard White wrote prolifically about both Will Rogers and Huey Long, and we talked with him in the first segment about these two gentlemen who were forces of nature and captivated the United States like few other people in history, and ironically died 26 days apart in the year of 1935, and both of them were being touted as presidential aspirants. Will Rogers may have actually been a better candidate if he had run, but Huey Long was building a power base to threaten the vitality of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. As they were killed in August and September of 1935, one in a plane crash, one in an assassination, what was it like for Franklin Roosevelt as he was looking over his shoulder?
Well, Roosevelt supposedly said he only feared two people. One was Douglas MacArthur on the right and Huey Long on the left, and for good reasons in both scores. Certainly Huey was a populist. There was a lot of there were other populists in the country who were very popular. People were looking for quick and easy answers during the Depression, so the atmosphere was ripe for a bandstander like Huey Long or even General MacArthur to really pose a serious threat to Roosevelt, whose popularity was not that great at the time. There was a lot of discontent over the Depression, over a lot of the social programs he had put in, the taxation. The business community was very anti-Roosevelt. So it was very tenuous political times.
Well, Huey was a master at the medium we're occupying right now at radio. And when I say he had millions of listeners, that's not an exaggeration, is it?
No, neither Huey nor Will Rogers. In fact, there's no analog out there for the two of them right now. In fact, the only person I've come up with who comes close to capturing all of the media that Will Rogers did, because he was in movies, on radio, he had a weekly column, he was guest speaker everywhere. Monopolized the media. The only person close to that was Oprah Winfrey at her heyday, I think.
Yeah, and you were on this show and said that, and I remember you asked me, is there anyone in public life who had the ability to captivate so many people in so many ways as Will Rogers was doing in 1935? And mind you, there was no television then. And Will Rogers, of course, was also a movie star in addition to everything else. And the person that floated in my mind, and I'm glad I didn't say it, was Donald Trump. But you gave a better example in Oprah Winfrey. Are we in a new day now where personality will trump everything else, and pardon the pun, when it comes to running for public office, particularly for the highest office in the land?
It always has been, but it is really increased. The media, social media especially, all the proliferation of small media outlets that are so targeted and so specialized, and the sophistication of manipulating the media with clickbait and everything else that's out there. It's the genie's out of the bottom, out of the bottle. You know, it is very charismatic. And also nepotistic. You know, the families because of all the notoriety there that goes with it. I'm worried that we're overpowering rationality. We're overpowering the issues with sound bites, with charisma, with hairstyles, you name it. And we're not getting to the heart of the matter that we need to get to.
Now, Will Rogers, I think he said, I don't belong to an organized party. I'm a Democrat. He was a guy who certainly had popularity with all political persuasions, people of all political persuasions. If he had run, how difficult of a candidate would he be to oppose?
I don't think there was, Will would have run. I don't think it was serious. I think it was more of a joke of his campaign. I just don't see it. He really liked being an outsider. He liked to be an honest broker. He was one of the only people who could walk into the Senate cloakroom unannounced. I don't see that as that viable. But I tell you, though, Jim, I miss Will Rogers right now. We could use a voice of reason, a person to bring us together, to bring logic to the debate in a very down-home style, to talk to the people, to tell the people, not to be fearful, to work together. Will Rogers was one of the first philanthropists in this country. His work for the Salvation Army and all the all the crises during the Depression, millions of dollars he raised before philanthropy was really a field. And a lot of his legacy is still out there financially. His voice in this time would be very, very important. We don't have that voice now. I wrote speeches for two presidents in the White House. I mean, I'm looking for that, voice of reason. The only fear, is fear itself, or call up the greater angels of our nature, and our Churchill's speeches. This is a time for that, and I see none of that hardly anywhere, not just in this country, but in other countries as well. And that's a product of what you're talking about, of losing the reason in our politics and becoming more dependent upon the sound bites and the clickbaits and the charismatic nature of where we're going.
Well, Huey Long, in the view of the host of this program, the humble view, got more done than the current president of the United States. Louisiana was changed forevermore by the kingfish, and the university that you have represented for 22 years was a big beneficiary of Huey's his mission to make LSU a powerhouse university. It still resonates all these days later, but he punished his enemies, no doubt, and he used a hammer rather than a feather brush when it came to his politics. And Donald Trump, in many ways, getting back to what we talked about in segment one, he's a Huey from the right. Do you think that this is anything he was aware of, or is he just doing this because he's Donald Trump and this is the way he rolls? Or do you think he's fully aware of the legacy of Huey Pierce Long?
No, I don't think he has any awareness of Huey. Trump's been like this since, forever. I mean, his TV show where he fired people every day, I think really was very clear of his personality, which is true today. He likes the hammer, and he doesn't like anyone who's disloyal or any sort of criticism. Huey was the same way. Remember, Huey had a bill to shut down the press in Louisiana. it never went through. It would have probably been unconstitutional. But, you know, I mean, if Trump could do that, you know he would. But there's a lot of not a lot of analogies there. Because, you know, even though Huey was from the left and Trump was from the right, the main characteristic is narcissism. And both are very strong narcissists, in good and bad ways. You know, narcissists have great vision. They get things done. They're very action-oriented. But at the same time, there's some personality issues there as well.
Well, Richard White, congratulations on what has been a fabulous career that continues.
Absolutely.
And we will, of course, stay in touch. But July 1st, it'll be the end of the trail as dean for Richard White, but he has an immense legacy both in academia and in his biographical works. So we will continue talking to Dr. Richard White. Thank you, sir. This is Jim Inkster, and this is our Memorial Day broadcast, and we are switching from politics to music, and we have one of the fine musicians and singers in the world who happens to live in Baton Rouge and performs regularly, Rusty Yates. Good morning to you, Rusty.
Good morning.
Well, Rusty, things are kind of tough right now. It's been 9 weeks since the governor imposed the stay-at-home order, and what's it been like for people who are constantly performing at night spots that are either open at reduced capacity or not open at all?
Well, I know personally for me, and I feel safe in saying this, when I can at least go on this one thing, I can speak for probably the other musicians that, you know, aside from it being our living, which is, you know, just like anyone else, it's very important. So we don't have any money coming in for the most part. But when you're a musician, you want to play. I mean, that's what you do, you know. And I was surprised to find out myself, and I've been playing music for 40 years professionally and a little bit longer than that when I started playing the piano. If you don't play for several weeks in a row, not only do you miss it, but when you sit down, to me, it feels strange. And then I had to actually work on some songs and to get to keep my, you know, my chops up, as they say. I bet you that's true for a lot of other musicians as well.
And when you say play, you play and play and play, sometimes two or three gigs in one day, approximately, ballpark, how many performances a year do you participate in?
Well, let's see. I work 4 days a week, and on some of those days I double up. So I don't know, 200, 220.
220 engagements a year, and we're talking about a high-energy performance in which you're giving your heart, your soul, in some cases your body. We've talked about some of these places for years and still do allow smoking, and you're breathing secondhand smoke. But you have been a good sport about it. You believe it's part of the game.
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's just part of the game. I grew up in that. It never bothered me. I smoke, as you know, I smoke cigars. We did a segment on your show about that. And I go to the doctor every year, and I'm healthy. So,
yeah.
But, you know.
Well, one of your more popular places in Baton Rouge is Churchill's, and I know you have other venues as well. I've seen you many times at Gino's and elsewhere. Rusty is a ubiquitous presence, and you always know when you hear Rusty Yates. He sounds more like Michael McDonald than Michael McDonald. And but does it ever get old, or is this something that's in your blood?
Well, both. It's in my blood. But just like anybody else, when you play as often as myself and some of the other professional entertainers out there, I'm sure it gets to be, you know, I know it does for me. I need time off, just like everyone. And I've got the time off. I just didn't plan for it to be like this.
And you're not, you know, like local journalists. You're not paid the same way that national and international figures are. You make a good living, but you have to work hard to do it. And when that is just completely cut off, what happens?
You better have saved some money. You know, I mean, I don't know if you want to get into this or not, but I know that they had and I'm very much a person who believes in taking care of yourself and don't want any help from anybody. But this is something that was unexpected. And so people might need some help. And they came out with this stimulus money and the gig money. They called it for gig. They came out. Well, I was surprised they came out with it, because people like us are usually the last person on the totem pole. But they came out with the gig money for they call it gig artists, people who are artists, professional musicians, sole proprietor. They're very aware, evidently, that there's people like us out there. They're supposed to have come out with it, and I went and filed for it just like a lot of other people have, but I don't know if it's going to go through or not. We'll see.
Well, when do you think you'll be back on stage on a regular basis?
Well, that all has to do with the proclamations from the governor. I thought it was going to be now, but I brought my equipment to Churchill's and everything, because that was the last job that I played when this happened. My equipment was still set up there whenever this started. My last date was on March the 14th. So when we read the proclamation, they were reading it, and they said, well, you can't play tonight. But the governor has said no music inside an establishment. So we're gonna do an outdoor event there.
Do you have concern that you are going to be exposed to this? Yeah, there's no doubt you will be exposed, or that you will contract COVID-19.
I mean, we've been keeping our distance. I take care of my mom. Everybody that knows me knows that. And so I've been we've been going to the same places around the same people, generally speaking, and keeping ourselves, kind of isolated. But there's always that concern. Everybody has that concern. But, and I've got my opinions about this thing. I know it's real, and I know it's dangerous and it's serious. But I think if it had been handled right from the beginning, it might be over by now. And that is, if we would have protected our older people and the people who are vulnerable to it, the most vulnerable, the people that it can really get, the very young, the older people who have a low immunity, low immune systems, and just protected them. And I think if everyone had been exposed to it, we would have built up a herd immunity by now.
Well, it's going to be a while, and it's an uncertain world, and your particular line of work has been affected immensely. I would imagine you hear from your colleagues quite a bit, too.
I do. It just goes to show you, not that I don't love my friends that play music, but we're in the music business and we're always playing at pretty much at the same time, out at night playing music. So you don't hear from them as much. When this started happening, after a week or two, I started hearing from people. I was getting text messages and people calling and asking how I was doing. And I was doing that myself. It's our own little community, just like anything else, I guess.
Rusty Yates is our guest for this segment, and he's been doing his thing for 40 years. He's a ubiquitous presence in Baton Rouge night spots. If there is a night spot, he's probably played there, and he is a regular at places like Churchill's and has been at Geno's many Thursday nights. And when he holds court, when he's doing his thing, you know he's around because he draws a crowd. He's very good at what he does. At one point, you went to Las Vegas and had some success. Why did you come back?
I went to Las Vegas when I was 19 years old. I just turned 20 when I got there, and I stayed there from 1980 until 1990 with a one-year detour in Seattle, because some friends of mine that lived in Vegas moved to Seattle, and I went up there to visit them, and I ended up staying for a while because it was such a beautiful place when you could see it, when the weather permitted. I went back to Las Vegas, and I performed for about five more years there, and I came back because there was a country singer by the name of T.G. Shepherd.
I remember him well. He's still around.
He's still, he's a real nice person. I can tell you, he's just a great guy.
I loved him, everyone.
That's right. And he saw me perform at the Desert Inn back this. I performed at the Old Vegas. There's nothing that was there, hardly anything that is there now that was there then. I played the Old Vegas, the Dunes, the Sands, the Desert Inn, Caesar's Palace, the Flamingo. I played all those. And he saw me there, and he advised me. He said, look, you could be the next Lee Greenwood if you want to be. And he said, I used to be the vice president of Arista Records. And he said, I know when somebody's got the ability to do something and you have it. He said, but you don't need to be in Vegas. Either move to California, move to Tennessee. He said, write and record and perform as often as you can. And he said, but a really good thing to do would be to go back where you're from. He asked where I was from, and I told him, he says, I would go back there and make yourself known where you are and keep writing and recording and performing, and then try to contact some management, someone that has some clout. And he said, then you draw the attention because you're out. Because when you're in Nashville, there's so many people there. When you're in Los Angeles, there's so many people there that they kind of get overlooked because everybody's at the door trying to get in. He said, if you went home and you made yourself as popular there as you could, then you could draw the attention because they're always looking out somewhere. When they're the, right. the producers and the people, the heads of the music in these big places are always looking for musicians out somewhere. They're looking in Texas. They're looking in Louisiana. They're looking in other states. So,
well, you did play briefly, maybe a little more than briefly, with Wayne Newton.
Yeah, we did. I did one show with Wayne Newton way back there, and Jan and Dean. In fact, there's a story, and I didn't hear this from Wayne Newton. I heard it from his guitar player, but after I met Wayne, and of course, we didn't do the show with him. We opened up for that situation. But I don't even know if he knew I was there. I didn't think he did. But his guitar player came up to me and said, look, you're about to get fired. Because I was performing with this, I won't even say who she is, but I was performing with this female singer, and she hired me to do duets with her. And the guy said that Wayne sent a message. He said, Wayne told me, he said, this guy's going to get fired. And I said, why? He said, because when you're with her on stage and y'all perform together, you're getting standing ovations and everything's going great. I said, well, then why would they fire me? He said, well, because she's used to doing that on her own. She doesn't want the competition. So I didn't look at it as competition, but sure enough, man, about 3 months later, we were supposed to go to Atlantic City. And she said, look, you just need to be on your own. Like, you don't need to be doing shows with me. So I put a band together, and we became one of the bigger bands on the strip there back in the 80s, and did quite well. You know, we worked mm-hmm. all the time, and I've been blessed, man. I've been playing music my entire life, and I've been able to make a living at it. So to me, that's successful.
Well, keep on going. Be safe, and we'll see and hear you soon. Rusty Yates, been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Happy Memorial Day. Thank you. This is Jim Engster, and we're visiting with a remarkable writer, Taya Hotchkiss. She's a sharp writer, an eclectic performer, and is known for her irreverent style. And this is something that I think we're going to find out very quickly. She is a bit different than most guests we talk with. She's been entertaining readers with honest, crass, and sometimes heart-wrenching depictions of her extravagant life experiences in the early 2010s in Milan. She now lives in Los Angeles, and she has produced The Last Party. And good morning to you, Taya. The Life of the Party.
Hi, good morning.
I'm sorry. Yes. Life of the Party is the book.
Well, and now it feels like The Last Party.
Yeah, no,
we're not going out anymore.
Well, yeah, let's start there. These are crazy times, especially for somebody as social as you are. How do you get past no party scene?
It's hard. We're all spiraling. Even my dog is like, Mom, when are you going to leave me alone for 6 hours like you used to? It's hard because a lot of my friends work in nightlife, or, you know, we just go out a lot. But, you know, my friends are DJs or promoters or dancers. And we're all just trying to find a way through, you know, Instagram, through Zoom. I actually had a virtual book launch party on my Instagram Live. I had to do it in the morning for my Italian followers. So at 10 a.m., I was popping champagne. I had a disco ball going. You know, it's a little bizarre. It doesn't feel right, but it feels better than nothing. And that's what we're doing.
Well, you're a fun person, and these are not fun times, though. How do you get past the dystopia that we're facing?
Well, to be honest with you, living in L.A., it actually doesn't feel that different day to day, because L.A. is already kind of a social distancing place. Everyone kind of stays in their car. stays in their mansion. And then I, you know, I'm a writer, so I'm usually at home with my dog during the day. But then at night, the reality sets in. I've watched everything on Netflix. I've watched everything on Hulu. I've watched everything on HBO. Now I'm just, like, watching myself in the mirror, trying to hold conversations with myself. So, yeah, that is very dystopian. I don't really know how we can get past it aside from just kind of pretending that it's not happening some of the time. Delusion is the best way to get through dystopia.
Well, you've chosen to live in L.A., though. Why? Why?
Yes.
Why are you there if you don't find it as stimulating as New York and Milan?
Well, exactly the reason. So, you know, I've always been a writer and a party girl. And the thing about New York or Milan is that you just want to be out all the time. You want to walk around the city. You know, everyone wants to meet you for a coffee, which leads to this, which leads to that. In L.A., I'm able to really focus on my writing. I've wanted to write a book for 10 years. It wasn't until I moved to L.A. that I was able to focus and to do it.
You grew up as a Croatian immigrant. And you've obviously found a lot of things in life that you find full of joy, and you're, of course, as I say, irreverent. You're not incapable of taking some shots at what you don't like. But how did this unusual pursuit of life that you have embraced come about?
I think that because I left Croatia at age 4, because one of my first memories is being on an airplane, I've never been really tied down to any place. So it was easy for me. You know, when I came to Milan, I was only supposed to be there for a study abroad program for 4 months. And then I was supposed to go back to Appalachian State University, which is where I started college. And all of the other Americans that came with me abroad, they all stuck together. They didn't really venture out. Me, after 2 months, I called my mom and I said, I'm living here forever. I'm never going back to America, which, you know, eventually I did. But I think that as growing up as an immigrant, it helped me be an immigrant for the rest of my life. I just don't, you know, the moment that I start getting used to a lifestyle, it's ready for a new one. I'm ready for a new one.
The book is Life of the Party, and it's largely focusing on this interesting life of this young person, Teja Hacic, and she spent some quality time in Milan, and you loved it, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. It was so inspiring, so glamorous.
You say the parties there are the most glamorous. Why?
Yes. Because, you know, since Milan is decadent and since a lot of what comes from Milan is clinging to the past, you know, they make fashion trends, and they're still very relevant. I mean, Italian Vogue is the best Vogue. But a lot of what makes Milan so beautiful is what came from it in the past. So the parties are kind of the same. Like you go to a fashion party there, and it's fountains, and they've just spent too much money trying to maintain this kind of image, which I don't think is actually sustainable or good for their economy, but it's great for a party girl.
Now you know that Milan and New York City, places you love, have been hit hard by coronavirus, and much harder than has Los Angeles. And maybe some of the reasons are entailed in what you're describing as the roots of those cities.
Oh, yeah. There's such social places. I mean, well, in Milan, you kiss to say hello. In New York, you can't get 3 feet away from someone, much less 6 feet. You find, you know, a rat in your pocket every morning. So I think those places have that cafe culture, which is something that a lot of American towns try to emulate. For example, here in L.A., they try to make a cafe culture on Melrose or on Sunset, but it's so fake. You can just feel that it's fake. The cafe culture in New York and Milan or other European cities, they've been creating that for generations, and I think it was really hard for people there to stay away from their social practices of, you know, having a aperitivo at 5 p.m. I really feel for them.
Teja Hacic is with us. Her book is Life of the Party. She lives in Los Angeles. She doesn't like it sounds, nearly as much as New York or Milan. You describe the city that you now inhabit as swimming pools, crystals, cacti, Botox, and the bars close at 2 a.m. What a bummer.
Yes. Can you believe it? The thing is, I've been, when I first came and saw that the bars closed so early, because, you know, I used to go out. I would always be out until 6 a.m. at least. It's rude not to. It's rude to go home before 6. But here the bars close at 2, and so you've got a choice. You go home to your dog, or, you know, you go to some failing actor's, you know, McMansion in the hills, and you realize, is he renting this place? None of this furniture looks owned. So I usually choose to go home to my dog. But like I said, it's not necessarily that I don't like LA. It's that it suits who I'm trying to become now, which is someone who spends more time writing than they do dancing. I still love a good dance, but I think 4 hours is enough. It doesn't need to be 12 hours anymore.
Well, you deal with all facets of your life and life of the party, and you note that it hasn't been all fun and frivolity. You've dealt with eating disorders, abusive boyfriends. Mm-hmm. How was it dealing with those issues?
Well, I mean, in retrospect, I can laugh about it and I can talk about it very easily because, in fact, I want young people, of course, especially girls, but young people of all genders and types and even people who are into sports who I wouldn't have been friends with, I'm saying I want you to know that whatever you're going through, it will pass. It might take years. You might cry every day, but it will pass. It's worth waiting for it to pass. And when it's all over, you know what? You've got a great sense of humor now. You know, I think the only reason why I kind of purposely became a funny person because I was struggling for half of my life just to, you know, wake up in the morning. And now I'm honestly one of the most cheerful people you'll meet. But I think, you know, struggle teaches people a lot, and not to romanticize it or anything. But it was rough. But now, you know, I can just be excited that I get to eat at a restaurant and not feel bad about it afterwards, which is something I would have never been able to do.
You think
now
you...
I get to appreciate. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Now is a new day, supposedly. But
yeah.
you say your life changed when you were in high school, when you were in the girls' bathroom and found a copy of
Weetsie Bat.
Now, that's not the book that usually changed people's lives, but it changed yours, and you say in a very good way. What happened?
Oh, yeah. So first of all, I used to show up to high school like 2 hours before class started because it was the only time that I could actually feel safe in my high school and happy in my high school. So I would just roam the halls listening to music. And, yeah, one day I found a copy of this book. And it's a very strange book. It's not, you know, The Catcher in the Rye. The cover was like, it looked like an acid dream. And it's a very small book. It's a brief book. And it's about this wild teenage girl living in Los Angeles. And just the way it was written, I'd never read anything like that before. And I decided on that day, I said, I need to write a book one day. It took 15 years eventually to do it. But I recommend that you all check that book out. When you buy mine, buy that one as well.
You say you like a vodka martini with pickle juice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know some people would disagree to even call that a martini, but I think it's the perfect drink. Pickle juice is actually the secret for many Slavic women like me, how we prevent being hungover. You just drink pickle juice straight from the jar. But, you know, before the hangover, you got to make the martini. So you just mix some vodka with pickle juice, a few pickles, some vermouth, and it's gorgeous.
Well, before we leave, tell us about Winkle.
Winkle, she's my daughter, my dog, my best friend. She actually is from Puerto Rico. She was on the streets of Puerto Rico, but I adopted her in New York. And she's been traveling with me. She's been to so many places, so many countries. And she's just the smartest little dog. Recently, one perk to the quarantine is she's been off leash with me every day because there are no cars really in my neighborhood. So she's like, oh, my God, did I win the lottery? The downside is she hasn't been able to sniff another dog's butt in a long time.
Well, you like to dress, and you certainly make an impression when you enter a room. If there were a big event now, and we haven't had a few of those, haven't had any of those in a while, how would you do it?
Oh, man. I mean, now I've been online shopping, and I don't know why, because I can't go out. So I think, honestly, I would wear everything at once. I would wear a dress as a hat, another dress as a skirt, a third dress as a top, and then I would, you know, turn pants into gloves. The next chance you get to go to a party, which who knows when that will be, just go all out.
Well, the book is Life of the Party, and I don't think we've heard the last of Taya Hachich. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and you're certainly a vibrant person.
Thank you so much.
Fill the microphone from afar with your personality and keep going, Tia. Tia, it's been an honor to meet you.
Thank you. You too. Have a great day.
Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services.